This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome to this presentation to Juno Diaz of the Eisner Artist of the Year Award and Class of 63 presentation. We're very glad to see all of you here, and we're so delighted to have Juno Diaz back. This award, the history of this award, I am, by the way, Judith Kellogg. I'm interim director of the Cornell Council for the Arts and a member of the music faculty. This award began as administered by the Cornell Council and the Committee on the Arts, whose chairman, Nancy McAfee, regrettably is not with us this evening, but I'd like to thank her very much for her efforts toward this award. It was established in 1997 as an alumnus artist award, and through the generous contribution of Bruce and Judith Eisner, it was then, I believe in 2002, what year was it turned over to the Eisner Award? Jane was changed, 2002. Through this generous contribution and the Eisner's continuing efforts to make the arts vital on this campus and beyond, the award was then changed to the Eisner Distinguished Artist Award. And we're very pleased to have Bruce and Judith with us. I'd like to thank a few people who have made this possible. Elena Viramontes, who is from the Creative Writing Department, who is here somewhere, and Milton Curry. Milton Curry, who was the previous director of the Cornell Council for the Arts, who until this year was in charge and saw that all of this came together so beautifully. The design for the gorgeous award, which you see over here, was designed by Eric Hilton, a wonderful glass artist. I'd like to thank the Latino Studies Program, who organized this afternoon's panel, who I think many of you probably heard, which was a fantastic event on immigration and the arts. The Committee on the Arts, of course, and Nancy McAfee. And let's see, am I leaving anyone out? If I am, I'm terribly sorry. And finally, I would like to introduce Stephanie Vaughn, who nominated Juno Diaz for this award and is a professor of English in the Creative Writing Department and has known Juno since his student days. And you graduated in, what, 92? 94. So they've gone back. We never talk about those details. And so I'd like very much to introduce Stephanie so she can give you a little bit of background on Juno Diaz. Thank you.
Although I am here as a representative of the Department English Creative Writing Program, I'm also a former chair of the Council for the Arts, and I would like to thank also the Eisners, and I would like to thank all of you who have been supporting the arts all these years, and all of you who are going to graduate and become the alumni who support the arts in the future. As you know, the arts are in peril, along with everything else in our country, and the arts are, along with things for children, the first to be cut from any budget. It is a testimony to the sagacity and the generosity of spirit of the faculty members of the Council for the Arts that they voted to nominate Juno Diaz for the Eisner Award the month before Juno Diaz won the Pulitzer. All right. although the award nomination did come out of the creative writing program, and I wrote one of the letters because I was director last year, and although it was supported by the Dean of Arts and Sciences and then approved by President Skorton, the nomination actually originated with Milton Curry, who was then the chair of the Council for the Arts. So this is a truly ecumenical award. I have known Juno Diaz since his first year at Cornell. I cannot say I had any influence on his work whatsoever, and maybe that's a very good thing. But I can say that he worked as hard on his fiction as anyone who's ever passed through here, and I've been here a long time now, and not just writing his fiction, but reimagining his fiction, rethinking it, taking that extra step that the real writers take. Most of what is bound in his MFA thesis was reimagined and became part of his first book, Drown, which was one of the things that landed him on the cover of Newsweek. His work from the beginning was funny. It was also ferocious. He seduces you with his rhythmic, gorgeous prose, his apt metaphors, his comic scenes, his street dialogue, his irreverence, his love of language, his far-ranging field of reference and allusion. And just when you are getting comfortable in the fiction of Junot Diaz, he will make you take a look at an inconceivable cruelty or misfortune. The chewed-off face of a boy who had once been attacked by a pig and whose mask is now being ripped from his head by a tough boy who himself has suffered misfortune. Or the body of a young woman who has been beaten nearly to death and will never again be quite so beautiful as she was the night before. He writes a kind of bilingual prose, or rather an English prose that is recasting and remaking English as a language in which Spanish words are as familiar as English words. His fiction is bicultural. He's an American writer. He is recasting American fiction, and yet also he is a Dominican writer who is making Dominican fiction. At Cornell, Junot Diaz was an activist whose work and whose protests were instrumental in reformulating what was then called Hispanic American Studies into what we now have as Latino Studies, and whose mission and activities are both, that new program, are both broader and more focused than they were before Junot Diaz passed through here. He was also part of a group that protested the unfair practices, hiring practices of illegal immigrants who weren't being paid anything at a pizzeria on North Aurora Street, and in fact helped put that pizzeria out of business. And if I could be allowed one anecdote, I remember I was sitting with some other people in the window of one of those North Aurora Street venues, and someone said, you know, I didn't see Junot at school today. And about 30 seconds later, a protest came marching down the street, and he was leading it. And they were on their way to that pizzeria to save the people who had been brought illegally into this country and were being underpaid and exploited. When I knew Junot here, he used to like to say that he wanted to be the first famous man from the Dominican Republic who was not a baseball player. He has succeeded. In addition to the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Critics Circle Award, Junot Diaz has won the Prix de Rome from the American Academy of Rome, where he was in residence last academic year. He has won an Ainsfield Wolf Book Award, a Dayton Literary Peace Prize, a Eugene McDermott Award, a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation, a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Award Fellowship, there are many more, and a Penn Malamud Award, all for a career that is still a young career. As of today, he has also now won the Eisner Award as the Distinguished Artist Alumni of the Year from Cornell, and Judith will help me in presenting it. Thank you.
Eric Hilton's beautiful rendition. There's a lot of history that goes into his design, which there's a circle here, an etched circle that's the circle of culture and education, and it's a very beautiful, if you have a chance to come up and look at it from all different angles, it's quite wonderful. I don't want to touch it.
Okay.
Why don't you touch it?
We'll just do it this way.
Careful, they're not attached.
Oh, the never
black,
mind.
Yeah, no, no, the black piece isn't attached to the glass piece.
Okay.
That's okay.
Sort of just lift it.
Stephanie, it's kind of like a Super Bowl trophy.
Oh, my.
Right, it's...
Yeah. So...
All right, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We are very delighted that Juno has agreed to do a brief reading from his work for us, so I'm really looking forward to that, and I will now leave the floor to you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, thank you both.
Oh.
Thank you so much. It's a tremendous honor. Look, first of all, you know, I want to thank the Eisners. I wish they would stand for us because this is really... And Professor Stephanie Vaughn wasn't kidding. We're hoping there's at least 12 of you who will do the same. Philanthropy is almost never modeled. Yeah, it's certainly not modeled where I came from or where I studied, and it's important to see it because it's something to aspire to. Yeah, and I want to extend my deepest thanks not only for myself as an individual, but for all of us who are part of the Cornell community have benefited so tremendously from your commitment to the arts and your commitment to our community. So thank you so much. I also wanted to thank everyone who was involved in this, Milton and all the folks who made this happen. You got to remember the sort of work that it takes to do this. Even the introduction that Stephanie gave, the tremendous, wonderful introduction, I'm sure it did not take 5 minutes to write. We are always the product of other people's invisible labor and invisible love. And it's easy to forget, just because someone's up here receiving the prize, forget what exactly made it possible. And almost always you're standing on a ton of people's unacknowledged and often unrewarded work. Yeah, and I think that that's incredibly important. Stephanie, poor Elena Maria Viramontes, who's had to put up with my irascibility the last few days, but a whole group of people from the Council of the Arts. This is an important thing, that these things are only happen because there's a community of people who believe in the arts and who attempt to make the arts accessible. Yeah, and I always think that these moments, a moment such as this one, is less of an excuse to celebrate one individual than an opportunity to celebrate the community that makes these things possible. And you are very fortunate to belong to this community, even if it's only for a few years, if you're passing through. It's a remarkable place for the arts, yeah? And it's something well worth celebrating. I'm just an excuse for y'all to celebrate yourselves, yeah? So... Yeah, with that said, I got to say, this is where I learned to be a damn artist. Yeah, the debts you owe to the people who make you possible are endless. I mean, the one thing about ourselves is that we're good at our grievances, man. You know, we tend to nurse what we didn't receive because that is a far easier emotion to handle than to acknowledge what we did receive. Gratitude is the most difficult of human emotions, and it is the one that, when you actually master, signals that you've reached true adulthood. Yeah? And it's one that I've wrestled with for many years, and it's remarkable the debt that I owe Cornell, that I owe the Creative Writing Department, that I owe the arts in this place, that I owe the Latino students here, that I owe my faculty members, that I owe my Latino faculty members, that I owe the African-American studies program here, that I owe JAMA. It's remarkable the amount of people who make a single kind of nerd possible. Yeah? So it's about a billion thanks. I think there's like so many other people that I could thank as well. But you should know, for real, for the how little we are, what's stranger is that it took a tremendous amount of work to make us little ones possible. Yeah? And I think I find myself spending most of my time trying to figure out how to be appropriately grateful, yeah, for the people who put in all this work. And guys, they don't fucking need to do it. I mean, this is what we forget. Nobody needs to do this stuff. Yeah? No one. And most people do it not because they're getting a paycheck, because if you've seen the paychecks, they're not that big, but because people deeply in love. They're deeply in love. And what they're in love with is that great shining abstraction, the arts. Yeah? So I'm just going to read something very small. Yeah. Briefest. Yeah. And then we will let it go. Okay? So I'm just going to read from the end of the book, yeah? So this, I mean, I read this novel, and it's, I guess there's not much you need to know, because it's the sort of the end of the book is inscribed in the title, yeah? So it's not a spoiler to tell you the character, the main protagonist dies, yeah? So it's kind of like a chronicle of a death foretold. You could never say, oh, you ruined the goddamn ending, you know? So it's not going to happen, yeah? So I'll just read something very brief. Yeah, and, almost before I forget, guys, you know what Stephanie was saying about me being an activist? I want to be really clear that those of us who were grad students when we were here, the entire activist movement, the Latino and African-American activist movement when I was here, was run by the undergraduates. The grad students, we were just there to kind of like, you know, correct the commas. You know, and I mean that most wholeheartedly. I mean, I never did any real leading. I just was a participant in a movement that was completely run and that was generated by the undergraduates. Yeah, and I think that that was also an incredibly humbling thing, because, you know, grad students think they're mad cute, you know, but we didn't do shit compared to those undergraduates. And in some ways, I've always been in awe of what it means to be young. Yeah, all right, so you don't need to know the end. This is, I mean, you don't need to have the end ruined, but this is the last 27 days of our principal character. His name's Oscar. He has returned to the Dominican Republic to try to reclaim the woman that he loves, who happens to be the girlfriend of a murderous, corrupt policeman named the Capitan, or the Captain. And Oscar returns despite wisdom and warnings, you know, and his family's own imprecations. He returns to try to reclaim this girl, her name is Yvonne. And so these are the last days of Oscar. Wow. How incredibly short are 27 days. One evening, the Capitan and his friend stalked into the riverside, and Oscar stared at the man for a good 10 seconds. And then, whole body shaking, he left. He didn't bother to call his friend, the taxi driver, Gleavis. He just jumped in the first ride that he could find. And once, in the parking lot of the riverside, Oscar again tried to kiss Yvonne, and she turned away with her head, but not her body. "Please don't," she said. "He'll kill us." 27 days. He wrote on each and every one of them, almost 300 pages total, if his letters are to be believed. "I almost had it, too," he said to me one night on the phone, one of the few phone calls he made to us. "What?" I wanted to know. "What did you almost have?" "You'll see," was all he would say. And then the expected happened. One night, he and Gleavis were driving back from the world-famous riverside, and they had to stop at a light. And that was where two men got into the cab with them. It was, of course, the Capitan's men, Gorilla Grodd and Solomon Grundy. "Good to see you again," Grodd said. And then they beat Oscar as best they could, given the limited space inside the cab. This time, Oscar didn't cry when they drove him back to the cane fields. Safra would be here soon, and the cane had grown well and thick, and in places you could hear the stalks clack, clack, clacking against each other like triffids, and you could hear Creole voices lost in the night. The smell of the ripening cane was unforgettable, and there was a moon, a beautiful full moon, and Gleavis begged the men to spare Oscar, but they laughed. "You should be worrying," Grodd said, "about yourself." Oscar laughed a little too through his broken mouth. "Don't worry, Gleavis," he said. "They are too late." "Actually," Gorilla Grodd said, "I would say that we are just in time." They drove past a bus stop, and for a second, Oscar imagined he saw his whole family getting on the guagua, even his poor dead abuelo and his poor dead abuela, and who was driving the bus but the mongoose, and who is the cobrador but the man without a face? But it was nothing but a fantasy, gone as soon as he blinked. And when the car stopped, Oscar sent final telepathic messages to his mother, "I love you, Senora," to his sister Lola, "I'm sorry it happened, I will always love you," to all the women he had ever loved, Olga, Maritza, Anna, Jenny, Natalie, and all the other ones whose names he had never known, and of course, to Ivan. They walked him into the cane and then turned him around. He tried to stand bravely. They looked at Oscar, and he looked at them, and then he started to speak, the words coming out like they belonged to someone else, his Spanish good for once. He told them that what they were doing was wrong, that they were going to take a great love out of the world. Love was a rare thing, easily confused with a million other things, and if anyone knew this to be true, it was him. He told them about Yvonne and the way he loved her, and how much they had risked together, and that they had started to dream the same dreams and say the same words. He told them that it was only because of her love that he had been able to do the things that he had done, the things they could no longer stop. Told them that if they killed him, they would probably feel nothing, and their children would probably feel nothing. Not until they were old and weak or about to be hit by a car. And then they would sense him waiting for them on the other side. And over there, he would be no fat boy or dork or kid no girl had ever loved. Over there, he would be a hero, an avenger. Because anything you can dream, he said, you can be. They waited respectfully for him to finish. And then they said, their faces slowly disappearing into the gloom, "Listen, we'll let you go if you tell us what fuego means in English." "Fire," Oscar blurted out, unable to help himself. Thank you.